is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good evening, Bahamas, and welcome to The Urologist Speaks. This is Bahamian urologist Gregory Pinto, and I'm joined by my co-host, Bahamian urologist Dr. Wesley Francis. Good evening. Thank you for giving up your time, Dr. Francis. It's a pleasure, as always, to have you here.
Good evening, Bahamas, and thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. Take an opportunity to educate the Bahamian populace on health concerns.
Well, on a basis, we're trying to rise the nation to a healthier place. This is a continuation from last week where we were discussing the all-important breast cancer in our nation. This is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, October. Tomorrow actually happens to be World Mental Health Day. October 10th throughout the world is celebrated and recognized with emphasis on mental health. On October 10th, so I'd like to discuss that and delve a little bit into that as well. I think we have a very, unfortunately, very stressed and very angry society, and I think it's important that we reach out to young persons in particular, and I'm stressing the young boys and men, but women as well, and help them on the path to not just a healthier physical life, but a healthier mental life as well. So we have the honor of having a regional and internationally recognized breast cancer expert in the form of Dr. Wesley Francis. So it's an opportune time to really get into breast cancer and understanding prevention, management. It's an overwhelming problem in this country, unfortunately, because of the genetics that we are unfortunately inherited in our small gene pool, particularly the BRCA gene mutations, type 1 and type 2. Unfortunately, a lot of young women are almost destined to have breast cancer, and we need to be very diligent in screening these individuals in particular. But when we think about management of breast cancer, and I'll even look at the parallel for prostate cancer, which is overwhelming in our country, we can manage prostate cancer minimally invasively. We can manage it external beam radiation, we can manage it with internal beam pellets of brachytherapy, which is a 40-minute outpatient procedure. We can heat it with HIFU, high-intensity focused ultrasound. We can cool it with cryotherapy. We can do removal of the actual prostate, radical prostatectomy, minimally invasively using little keyhole incisions, either laparoscopically or making use of the Da Vinci robot. But when we talk about breast cancer, unfortunately, Dr. Francis, the management is, for many women, disfiguring. And it's not just the physical toll of them surviving breast cancer, but actually the emotional toll as well. What is the role for lumpectomy or breast-conserving, sparing surgery in breast cancer?
So, thanks, Greg. Breast cancer management has evolved over the years, and I'd like to stress that. I mean, it's evolved. It's become more of a personalized medicine. One time ago, we if you had breast cancer, then it was almost a one-size-fits-all. You were destined to either get some form of surgery, whether that was a mastectomy or some chemotherapy. And in the past, breast cancer really was thought to be a surgical disease. But now it's evolved. And the reason why it's evolved, because we recognize that breast cancer is not just one single disease. It's very heterogeneous, meaning it's multifaceted, and it behaves very differently. I think in the clinical world, we substitute the term biology, but you know, it's really how it behaves within the individual. And so because the person is individual, the tumor is individual, then the treatment has to be individualized. When we think about breast cancer, it can be non-invasive or invasive. And non-invasive breast cancer is really what the whole aim of screening is to detect. We want to find breast cancer in a non-invasive stage. And what I mean by that is when the tumor is confined to the cells within the breast and didn't have an opportunity to spread either to the lymph nodes or to the blood vessels to get to other parts of the body. In that state, or during that stage, and we actually call that stage zero, you can cure breast cancer with just surgery alone. And that's removing the area. And the term lumpectomy is moving the lump or the disease with normal tissue around it. And that's as opposed to mastectomy, which is removing the entire breast. So lumpectomy is basically breast preservation. So the entire breast organ doesn't have to be removed. It has to be, however, combined with radiation. Because if you think about it, I mean, if I removed the entire breast, then I eliminate your entire chance of getting breast cancer. if it is that I just removed the area, then the rest of your breast is still at risk of getting another breast cancer. And so to mitigate that risk, that's why people get radiation. So when we talk about breast conservation, it's lumpectomy combined with radiation treatment. And what the radiation does is it treats the unaffected part of the breast, and that prevents any recurrence within the breast. And then that functionally makes it equal to a mastectomy or complete removal of the breast. This is something that women need to understand, because if you do that, the survival, meaning whether you live or die, is equal if it is that you have a lumpectomy with radiation or if you have a mastectomy. And there are countless numbers of trials and studies that have proven this, that there's no difference between the two in terms of survival, in terms of outcome. And the outcome measure that we're looking for is survival. We want women to be survivors. They can survive with their breasts. And so that's the main difference between mastectomy and breast conservation. In the past, again, we thought breast cancer, it grew in the breast, went directly to the lymph nodes, and then spread out. But then the treatment is now based on an understanding that if it's invasive, there's likely that they're spread from the outset. And so surgery alone does not really cure that situation. And this is where the evolution of systemic therapy, when I say systemic therapy, and chemotherapy is a part of that, that is what really makes the difference in patient survival. But if we catch it early in the non-invasive stage, and that's really the whole idea of screening and mammography, then, you know, women live and they can preserve their breasts.
So that, I would suppose, is a motivation for women. I'm sure as a breast cancer surgeon, your heart is breaking day in and day out to see women who've had these lesions, these masses that they've noticed for 8 months, they've noticed for a year and a half, and the stage is just continuing to advance. I think a lot of women have fear when they find something unusual, and obviously we're both advocating, as any surgeon would, to do at least once a month self breast examinations. You know what normal feels for you. And if you feel anything abnormal, it may be something, may not be something. It's best to be overly diligent. But not every mass is malignant.
Right. Clearly it's not. And Greg, I want to introduce the concept of breast awareness. women need to be aware of the breasts that they have, the contours, the shape, the feeling. And so practicing breast awareness, and that's where the breast self-exam comes in. And I'm not only putting this responsibility on women, right? I mean, I think the men, husbands should know, should practice breast awareness with their wives. I mean, I hope I don't get in trouble with this, but I often wonder sometimes when you see women come with these huge, large, masses in their breasts, they're married women, and or even, you know, like, how did that happen? Even if the woman didn't feel that, of course, if you're in a healthy relationship with, I would encourage all men to practice breast awareness. You should know, the contours, the texture and everything of your wife's breasts, and help with that screening. So screening can take multiple facets, right? There's the breast self-awareness. That's the self-exams. And then we call clinical breast exam. That's when you go to your practitioner and they examine you. And that's usually done on an annual basis. And then there's imaging. And imaging is where, well, currently we recommend mammography at age 40. That's when it starts, unless you're high risk. And in high risk individuals, it's individualized. But average risk women should start being imaged at age 40. But again, it's a continuum. It's self-awareness or breast awareness, and that can be done either by the woman or their partner, then clinical breast exam by your practitioner, and then imaging. So it covers everything. And really, again, I think I've said on the show before, and whenever I speak about this, we can't prevent breast cancer. And so the aim of screening is to early detect. And if you early detect, we can get 100% survival. As long as patients start to present at a later stage, with each increase in stage, the survival falls off. And so the aim is to find it at that non-invasive stage. And non-invasive breast cancer usually presents as calcifications within the ducts, and that is what is picked up by mammogram. And trust me, you would want to find these things even before they form a lump.
Well, we want this to be an interactive show, to ask the questions you were always afraid to ask. So you can text us on the Guardian Radio text line, which is 422-4796, which is powered by BTC, standard text rate supply. Or feel free to call us at 323-6232 or 325-4316. Or 326-4259, or call toll-free from the Family Islands, 242-300-5720. So we talk about local control of the disease and then systemic control. So if you go beyond stage zero, what's the role for chemotherapy?
Okay, so I'm going to say this, because chemotherapy, or, and let's say systemic therapy, and what I mean by systemic therapy, once you get breast cancer to be invasive, it has the opportunity to spread to the rest of the body through lymph nodes or through blood vessels. And what that means is, if you have a horse within a gate, you open up that gate and they can fly. So when that cell, or that cancer cell, gets that ability, it can go anywhere. And that could be a 1 centimeter, that could be a half a centimeter cell. So breast cancer, we believe, at its outset, can spread microscopically. So we know it, that it's out there. We don't pick these up until, for example, those cells circulating throughout the body then find somewhere to grow. Then we say that that's stage four. For example, if it grows in the liver, it grows in the brain, whatever, we call that stage four. So if the concept of the micrometastatic spread, that's when you look at it, that is when the tumor was in the entire system of the body. And so that's why we use the term systemic treatment. So when we look at, when we discuss treatment in the breast, we call that local treatment. When we discuss treatment in the bloodstream, that's systemic treatment. People die because of systemic failure or meaning when those microscopic cells then grow and form metastases in some other organ. So systemic treatment, which are many forms, one of the forms is chemotherapy, another form is hormonal therapy, another form is what we call targeted therapy, and then now there's immunotherapy. Systemic therapy has evolved to the point where it has become the primary treatment for breast cancer and is the primary cause for survival. So the treatment of breast cancer has evolved to the point where systemic therapy now is what is most responsible for patient survival and not surgery. And I'm going to repeat that because I'm a surgeon and I'm a surgeon saying that. Surgery is not the primary treatment for breast cancer anymore. It's systemic therapy what is responsible for survival. Now, a lot of people say to me, oh, I don't want that chemotherapy. No, chemotherapy is what saves lives. Or again, as I mentioned, systemic therapy, which chemotherapy is a form of systemic therapy. That is what saves lives, not what is in your breast. I can remove a tumor from your breast. I can remove the breast itself. But the microscopic stuff that is already spread within the system, I cannot remove with my scalpel. And that is where the systemic therapy or chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, targeted therapy, immunotherapy, those are the therapy that actually saves people's lives.
Okay, we have a few texts coming in. Let me read one of the longer ones. He says, good evening, Dr. Francis, Dr. Pinto. Thank you for your wonderful efforts. My sister is a breast cancer survivor. Firstly, does that make me at higher risk? Second question, are all breast cancer patients candidates for a reconstruction immediately? And what happens if the cancer involves the areola and the nipples?
Okay, so first question, if a first degree relative has breast cancer, and that's in your family, then it adjusts your risk. It increases your risk of breast cancer. You're no longer an average risk. And there are a lot of risk tools that can calculate your risk. And once we calculate your risk, then we can adjust screening for you and have an individual plan for you. So yes, if a member of your family has breast cancer, then it automatically increases your risk. Secondly, in patients who are undergoing mastectomy, their options for reconstruction are available, and it's available locally. So a lot of people sometimes think that these options aren't available locally. So if you remove the breast, there's immediate reconstruction, which can be done at the same setting, or it can be done at a delayed setting. And this is where you have your surgical oncologist who works alongside your plastic surgeon. So it's the removal of the breast takes care of the cancer, and then the reconstructive or plastic surgeon comes and rebuilds the breast. So obviously it's important, because as the breast is a sexual organ, it's important that we preserve that and we preserve the way it looks. And especially in younger women, if we have younger women with breast cancer who are undergoing mastectomy, we recommend that they get immediate or delayed reconstruction. What goes into that decision is if there's a possibility of the person getting radiation. If the person is getting radiation, then we usually advise that it gets delayed because the radiation affects the quality of the skin and the quality of the cosmetic outcome. With respect to nipple areola, if the breast cancer is close to the nipple areola area, we do not recommend that we save that, because then if we do, then it increases your risk of recurrence. So it's an individual decision. It takes into consideration the location, the size of the cancer, and basically what the woman's desires are. And so, but all of these treatment options, all of these surgical options are available within the country.
And we make use of silicone implants. What are the options for reconstruction?
So reconstruction can either be implant-based or tissue-based. So tissue-based is where This plastic surgeon uses your own tissue. And this is where, you know, women get basically a tummy tuck at the same time and use the tissue from the abdominal wall to rebuild the breast. Or you can use implants, and the implants can either be saline-based or silicone-based. And again, all are available. And all of these options are discussed with your plastic surgeon, and the decision is made ahead of time.
And we discussed this last week, and we have, unfortunately, very high incidence and proliferation of BRCA gene mutation, and we also discussed particularly type 1 BRCA gene mutation has a significant increase in breast cancer incidence in this country, particularly for women under 40. So if you have are known and you've been tested because several members of your family have had breast cancer, should you opt for prophylactic mastectomy, and is that extend to hysterectomy, oophorectomy, because you are at risk for so many other cancers as well?
So again, whenever someone has the BRCA gene, they're at an increased risk of developing breast cancer within their lifetime. If it's BRCA 1, it's anywhere between 70 to 85%. If it's BRCA 2, it's a little less, between 45 and 65%. So with this increased risk, then the options available to that individual is, in the absence of not having breast cancer, is basically some form of risk reduction. Risk reduction takes several different forms. One, it could be aggressive screening, and this is where people are screened earlier, patients are screened earlier, and they're screened with a different tool. So the screening tool would be the addition of MRI to mammogram and ultrasound. So patients who are at high risk, which these patients are, they would, in addition to getting a mammogram and ultrasound, should also get an MRI. The screening should also start earlier. Women who are known BRCA positive should start screening at age 25, and it should include an MRI.
How frequently?
Annually. This is annually. And remember, screening takes different several options, right? The breast self-exam, we continue to recommend that. Clinical breast exam, although we recommend that on an annual basis, for patients who are BRCA, we say twice a year, okay? And then additionally, you should get your MRI with your mammogram and ultrasound. And then there's risk reduction through medication. And the medication that's recommended is tamoxifen. And what tamoxifen does, it reduces your risk of developing breast cancer. So in addition to aggressive screening, then you can get medication to reduce your risk. And then finally is where you can get risk reduction surgery. And that would be what we call prophylactic mastectomy, and removing the breast tissue. And this is where we encourage women who are doing this to get immediate reconstruction. And in these patients who do not have breast cancer, nipple sparing mastectomy is an option where you can preserve the nipple and the areola complex. The issue with that, though, it doesn't completely, it's not 100%. You reduce your risk by 99%. So patients still have a 1% risk of developing breast cancer. And yes, I have seen where patients who would have had a bilateral prophylactic mastectomy still may end up going on and getting breast cancer.
Okay, we have another text. I have found that a lot of women I know actually get diagnosed with breast cancer when they're pregnant. Is there a reason for this?
Well, so again, every woman has a specific risk of developing breast cancer throughout their life. And actually, pregnancy is supposed to be protective. Okay, so you would hear as part of the risk assessment, we would ask patients how much times you were pregnant and if you breastfeed. This is supposed to be a protective period, because the estrogen, which increases your risk of breast cancer, during pregnancy, your breasts pretty much get a holiday off of from the estrogen and during the breastfeeding. And that's why we encourage women to breastfeed. But if you had a risk of breast cancer, you can still get this during pregnancy. The only problem is that when it does occur during pregnancy, and we actually classify if you would have a breast cancer after, even up to 1 year after pregnancy, all of that is labeled or classified as pregnancy-related breast cancer. The problem with that is when you do get breast cancer during that period, it tends to be much more aggressive. And so pregnant women are encouraged to, again, do significant breast awareness, see their practitioner, and get clinical breast exams on a regular basis.
Okay, thank you for those educational words. We're going to get back to breast cancer, then go into other topics at the turn of the commercial. Take care.
Loss of family members is very isolating, and people who have experienced loss appreciate when others have shared their grief. If you can't be there in person, go to the Nassau Guardian's website online at thenassauguardian.com and visit our obituary link. The Nassau Guardian's interactive obituary link allows you to read the funeral announcement, express condolences, or place photos on the online guestbook for one full year. Losing a loved one is painful, but that pain isn't the worst thing to happen. Friends, loved ones, colleagues, and neighbors who ignore the loss compound the pain. Should the bereaved family wish to place the obituary and photos on our obituary site, just contact the Guardian's funeral industry partners or the Nassau Guardian. Remember, there isn't one magic right thing to say to someone experiencing loss that will make the loss less painful or easier to bear. The Nassau Guardian's obituary link, available online at thenassauguardian.com.
Hold on, sweetie. Mommy's sending a text.
But Mommy, my teacher said that you're not supposed to text and drive.
I know what I'm doing.
Oh, look, Mommy, the Smith twins. Mommy, watch out!
In 2017, approximately 54 people died as a result of traffic accidents. A percentage of these fatalities occurred as a result of texting while driving. Just taking your eyes off the road for 5 seconds can increase your chance of crashing. Remember, even the smallest voice counts.
Brought to you by UB Radio and Guardian Radio 96.9.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host, Bahamian surgical oncologist, Dr. Wesley Francis. It would be remiss if I wasn't going to bring up the bearing down of a historic hurricane, Category 4, Category 5, Hurricane Milton on the western shores of Florida. And our prayers are with them, and also our prayers are with our brothers and sisters in the northern Bahamas, Grand Bahama, Bimini's, and Abaco, and we're praying that we'll all be spared. But as medical practitioners, we need to be prepared. Anytime you're going to have a storm, because of global warming, we're always going to see Category 3, Category 4. If it's not 1 year, it's going to be next year or the year after. If you have non-communicable diseases, if you're a diabetic, if you have hypertension, if you have coronary artery disease, if you are on cardiac medication, we implore you, you at least to have at least a month's supply of your medication, whether it's insulin, etc. Some of the medications you have are refrigerated. You need to have a cooler at least to store them. You don't want to create one have one disaster create another disaster internally for you medically, particularly when a lot of the roads are going to be blocked, the hospital is going to be overwhelmed, the clinics are closed. If you need to seek medical care, it might not be readily available to you. So you may survive the storm and then be taken out by diabetes five days after the storm while we're still trying to clear the lands.
Yeah, and it's important that people really listen to the radio and to the local news rather than listening to the U.S. news, right? So that if they're asked to go into shelters, then, you know, take heed. You got to be very cautious. Storm surge is important. I think everybody remembers the storm surge associated, well, in Abaco and in Freeport, and we don't want anybody to be caught up in that. And so if you're asked to evacuate, please do so. And take extreme caution as we experience the onslaught of this storm.
And then even in terms of female sanitary pads and toiletries, making sure that you have sufficient diapers for your children, having formula for your children. You need to think ahead. You need to think that you may be isolated for weeks on end and that you need to be able to be self-sufficient yourself and for your family. If you know that your grandfather or your aunt lives in a dilapidated home, you need to make room, whether even if someone is sleeping in the floor, at least you can sleep sound and you're not going to have regrets that are they safe, and even if something happens, you're not going to be able to reach them in the heat of the storm.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, so we're talking a little bit on the break about you are very involved in the Cancer Society and in terms of the cancer registry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of misinformation in regards to the incidence of breast cancer in this country and the age of incidence, the average age compared to other countries. Can you shed some light on
that? So, right, it's important to first recognize that we do have a population-based registry. Now, registries can be hospital-based and registries can be population-based. A hospital-based registry we had, and that contains all of the information that comes out of that hospital. And so prior to 2018, all of the data on breast cancer came out of essentially Princess Margaret Hospital. The registry started in 2018. And so registry data takes a while to mature. And when we first got the information from 2018, the incidence of breast cancer was 100.6 per 100,000 females within the country. Prior to that, the numbers we were getting out of Princess Margaret Registry were about between 40 and 60. So you can imagine in 1 year, you saw the jump from around 40 to way over 100. So it meant that we weren't getting sufficient information. The population-based registry gets information out of all of the hospitals and private clinics. And it's not complete data, but it's the best data that we have. And over the past few years, we noticed that the numbers have been going down. So the last set of numbers, which again, the registry data is usually about 2 years behind. In 2022, we're looking at 69.3 per 100,000 females, which would mean in that year, we saw a little over or close to 200 women who had breast cancer in that year. Now, the registry gives you incidence data. That means the number of new cases, not the overall number. One of the things, breast cancer traditionally is a disease of older women. So if you look at registry data within the U.S., their average age is 60 and above. We've been seeing a lot more younger people or premenopausal women with breast cancer. But we still have a fair share of older women with breast cancer. And when you look at the average age within our registry, our current registry data, the average age is somewhere around between 56 and 57. But yet we still have a lot of women that are premenopausal. And the age cutoff we say for premenopausal versus postmenopausal is 50. The reason why we have a lot of premenopausal, and sometimes we see patients in their 40s, 30s, and even as young as 20s, it has to do with this BRCA gene that we have in our community. And we don't know the overall extent of it, but it certainly pushes downward pressure on the age. So we have much younger women presenting with breast cancer than we have, than you would see in other first world countries where breast cancer is really a disease of older women.
Do you know the approximate cost of if someone was interested in getting BRCA gene testing for themselves or their family members?
So, two things. First, if it is that you're diagnosed with breast cancer and you fit a certain criteria, premenopausal, triple negative, significant family history, high risk features, then insurance covers it. If it is that you do fall outside of that group, you do not have breast cancer and you do want to get your test, you can get tested in any lab. The cost of this has been going down. It used to be very significant before, but you can get it now for, I think, under $1,000. Okay? And that is if people want to go ahead and get their genes tested. But there are specific indications for doing BRCA testing with patients who come with breast cancer. Certainly if you're under 50, if it's a triple negative type, if you have a significant family history, and your risk of breast cancer overall is greater than 25%, these are patients who, again, we recommend that you get BRCA testing.
Another question a lot of patients will even ask me, they're survivors of breast cancer, it might have been 5 years, 7 years, 9 years, can they take any form of estrogen? Does that put them at greater risk? Is there a period where beyond a certain amount of years of remission that it's safe for them to take any form of estrogen?
You know, that's a very controversial topic. In fact, women who are hormone-positive breast cancers, we recommend that they get estrogen blockers. If they're premenopausal, they get what we call tamoxifen, because most of the estrogen is produced from your ovaries, and tamoxifen blocks estrogen in the ovary. If you're postmenopausal, your ovaries are pretty much shut down at that point, but the estrogen is produced within the fat cells called aromatase enzyme, and so we get an aromatase inhibitor. So we recommend that for those patients that they get an estrogen blocker. So it's been for a long time, we would say to women, avoid hormone replacement therapy, which is basically estrogen, because it can minimally increase your risk of breast cancer. And that's really the recommendation that women are given. So if it is that you need estrogen, usually very low dose topical estrogen, especially if women are experiencing vaginal dryness and stuff like that during, but it's not recommended that women get full blown, if you had a history of breast cancer, to get hormone replacement therapy.
Well, I'll look at the parallel as a urologist in prostate cancer, and we talk about hormonal replacement therapy, testosterone replacement therapy. Studies have shown over the last several decades that if you have been in remission for over 2 years from prostate cancer, and we've conclusively confirmed that, you are at no real increased risk, actually no increased risk, by getting testosterone replacement therapy, which is wonderful news because most men who are struck with prostate cancer are actually middle-aged, and that's the time where their testosterone level is going to fall. And unfortunately, testosterone for many of these men is very low, and it's going to affect their erections. So they've survived prostate cancer, and years ago you said, all right, you can't have any testosterone replacement therapy at all, but studies have now shown that it is safe after 2 years, which allows men to survive prostate cancer, and then you can actually regain your erections if you have age-related low testosterone. So I'll even go a little bit, stray a little bit away from the topic. Men are throughout this country, and I see it, just going for testosterone therapy. They haven't tested their testosterone. They don't know their prostate cancer status. And unfortunately, and I've seen it far too many times, it shouldn't even happen once, these men are literally, and I'm not exaggerating, committing suicide because Testosterone doesn't cause prostate cancer, but once you have prostate cancer, if you're going to give somebody testosterone, all you're going to do is cause early, even indolent disease to become very aggressive, to proliferate and progress rapidly. So before, even as any urologist and myself, obviously included, even considering anyone getting testosterone replacement therapy, we're going to do diligently in every way possible, even if it requires doing an MRI of your pelvis, determine whether you have prostate cancer. So testosterone doesn't cause prostate cancer, but if you have prostate cancer, testosterone can cause it to proliferate and progress. Thinking about it, even from a layman's point of view, when do you have the highest levels of testosterone? That's when you're in your 20s. Nobody gets prostate cancer in their 20s. So it's not that testosterone causes prostate cancer, but please, men, if you have erectile dysfunction, I've said it, and I'll say it again, and I'll always sing this, treat the root cause. It's not always low testosterone. It can be many things. It can be more than one thing. Usually it's as simple as a non-communicable disease, hypertension, diabetes, early coronary disease, hypercholesterolemia. As you get older, it can be an element of low testosterone, but taking it into your own hands and getting testosterone injections or pellets inserted, that can be the end of you, and that can be almost suicidal, because particularly we have all the risk factors in this country of having for prostate cancer and for breast cancer. But if you don't know your prostate cancer status, don't even consider getting testosterone replacement therapy. I know the most important organ for any man in this country, and you, I know as a physician, is your erection. We're getting texts now. I can't rise again is the general theme. How can you help me? We're going to get into that at the end. But we're trying to speak a little bit about the women. Obviously, erectile dysfunction affects the women as well. It affects the partners, the marriages. But let's just sum it up in terms of breast cancer. So you start with self-examinations at what age if you don't have any increased risk factors?
So I think women in their... Once you get in your 18, about should start breast self-exam. And again, it's an awareness. It's so that you can appreciate what's normal for you. We're not trying to turn you into a physician or whatever, or an expert, but we want you to know what's normal for you. It's recommended to do it right after your periods, because that's when the effect of hormones are less on your breasts. And then you know the contours of your breasts. And if there's any difference, and it's done every month, and if there's a difference, then and you can detect this difference, and many studies have shown that it's very sensitive, then you escalate to your primary care person, who will then do a clinical breast exam, and then after that point, we'll then order some kind of imaging to confirm whether or not it confirms the suspicion of any mass in the breast. What I want to end with, and I think we're going to go into some other things, is that never before have I been so hopeful about patients with breast cancer, because the treatment has really evolved. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, I would see women, especially with triple negative breast cancer, come in and you would think, oh, wow, this is very aggressive. But now with the new treatment modalities and understanding that systemic therapy is the way to go, we're now seeing where patients are getting, after they're diagnosed, they're started on systemic therapy and the tumors are melting away. And so the aim of systemic therapy now, and it's evolving, is getting so much better, is that we totally eliminate the disease in the breast. To the point that now I'm having conversations with women about, should you get any surgery after you've completed systemic therapy? The real answer is yes, but then they don't feel it anymore. And so that is why, and when we see women get this complete response in the breast, they do very well. And they're almost guaranteed same survival as if they're down to stage one or even stage zero. And this is why it's important, and I'd say to women, if you have, if you're facing the diagnosis of breast cancer, there's hope. There's hope because the treatment has evolved, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. We've gotten to the point where this is a personalized medicine, And we've not only, we can now get the subtypes of breast cancer and know exactly what treatment options that you should choose or that we choose for you. And the results, we're seeing excellent results with that. And so I'm saying this as a surgeon because surgery is not always the first option. In fact, the first option for surgery is becoming so limited now in terms of which breast cancers we start off with surgery. So systemic therapy is the way to go. And this is a surgeon telling you this because I have seen the benefits of systemic therapy, which includes chemotherapy. And I want to spread that like wildfire in the country because a lot of people are saying chemotherapy is this, that, that. No. Chemotherapy and targeted therapy, immunotherapy will save your life.
I think a lot of women and men, the general public, don't really understand the difference between immunotherapy and chemotherapy.
Right.
Can you, just in layman's terms, break it down?
So we were born with a defense system that allows our bodies to recognize something that is foreign and then able to attack what is foreign. Now, if you think about when the immune system turns on itself and you have these diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, that's your immune system going haywire. Immunotherapy is where we use your own individual immune system to then be able to appropriately recognize tumors and then use the immune system to then either channel drugs within those cancer cells to specifically kill those cancer cells and then allow the other cells in the immune system to then attack and kill. So it really makes the cancer cells more vulnerable to your own immune system. So it serves as one, it augments the recognition, and two, it allows better drug penetrance, and it also, the third thing is it allows your own immune cells to kill these tumors. What that does is that it reduces the side effects that you would get with chemotherapy, because chemotherapy does have some side effects. Now, immunotherapy has its own side effects, but what it does is allows for a more specific treatment, identification of tumor cells as foreign, and killing those tumor cells. And when you combine that with regular conventional chemotherapy, we're now seeing significant results.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about controlling your bladder. Regaining control of your bladder, regaining control of your happiness for men, women, and children. Thank you. This is Urologist Speaks.
You try to rest, but roll with the best. For all your printing needs, there ain't no one better, no. For posters and banners, magazines and flyers, for window decals, greeting cards and newsletters. No job too big and there's no job too small. You name it, we can print it, just give us a call. Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located at the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bala Boy on his phone.
What you mean? He take picture of that good for nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bala hair, you say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want to find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it will go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for Crime Stoppers Bahamas so you can call and nobody knows it's you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried it the other day, and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick round the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and Bahamian surgical oncologist Dr. Wesley Francis. I think we are implored to talk about erectile dysfunction. I count 8, 9 messages here asking about rising again. So obviously, as a urologist, erectile dysfunction is something under our purview, and it's overwhelming importance in this society, particularly for Bahamian men, and no one's going to argue that point. But let me just read one text. It says, I take the little blue pill, it doesn't work. Am I doing something wrong? So it goes back to the meat of the matter. Anything in medicine, you want to treat the root cause. So the blue pill, whether it's sildenafil, which is Viagra, or tadalafil, Cialis, or Levitra, they're going to enhance your erections and maybe will be able to camouflage a problem that might be brewing in terms of you possibly having uncontrolled hypertension, or you may have new onset diabetes or poorly controlled diabetes, or you may have a early onset of coronary artery disease, or you may have atherosclerosis, you may have obstruction of the smaller blood vessels supplying your male member, and that manifests as erectile dysfunction, which, if we don't turn the course, it's going to lead to obstruction of the larger blood vessels, such as the carotid arteries or the vertebral arteries. You're going to end up with a stroke, you're going to end up with a heart attack 10 or 15 years down the road. But just looking at it, the question on face value, is there a correct way of taking Viagra or taking Cialis? The answer is yes. You want to take it, particularly Viagra, you want to take it on an empty stomach. So if you just went out on a date with the wife or your girlfriend or your significant other and you just had a steak and or lobster and potatoes and a big dessert, and you feel stuffed, taking the Viagra at that point really is going to be very ineffective, because it's not going to be absorbed properly because it's competing with the other foods in your stomach to be absorbed. The same thing if you've had a lot of alcohol intake. I don't want to be crude, but there's actually a urologist term in terms of alcohol use before erections, where they call it whiskey dick. So you want to reduce your alcohol intake as well. But yes, take it. Unfortunately, Viagra doesn't allow you to be very spontaneous. So you have to be... Sorry, we're getting a call. Let's take a call. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Mangus. I was calling in reference to the question, the advice you gave the men to help do the self-examination for their wives. What exactly should you look for when you do that as a husband for your wife?
I'll let Dr. Francis
that one. I am so happy that a man calling here to ask about self-exam for their wives. Because, again, listen, it's very important. But it has to be done on a regular basis, because you're just looking for contours and looking for what is normal. I think if you examine your wife or a significant other's breasts, you'll come to realize what is normal. And if you do it often enough, you'll pick up something that is different. All you're trying to do is pick up something that is different. And if that is different, then you bring it to the attention of the professionals. In fact, I would say to you that just last week in clinic, we had a young woman who didn't even recognize that she had a lump in her breast, but it was a boyfriend that recognized it. So I'm putting it out there tonight that it's very important that men examine the breast of their significant other. Thank you for calling in for that, because, I mean, this, I think it's something that we don't talk about enough.
Okay, so it can be therapeutic, and it also can help with foreplay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see. You're opening up the floor for that. The floodgates are going to open, Dr. Francis. All right, so in taking Viagra, unfortunately, unlike Cialis, they call it the weekend pill. You take it on a Friday, you're good. Friday, the Saturday, Sunday, almost as many times as you want. You could take it with food, without food. Viagra, it's best to take it on an empty stomach. That's up to 3 hours after you've eaten. You got to wait at least an hour for it to be dissolved in the stomach. So you got to plan your day a lot. Cialis allows for more spontaneity. But stop taking these unregulated medications. I don't want to hear any more about the Chinese lozenge, or I don't want to hear about this backbone or backwood or whatever the latest name is. These are unregulated medications. We want to treat the root cause. It can save your life. I can't count on my hand how many times in a given week alone I've diagnosed someone with hypertension or diabetes or early heart disease or high cholesterol or obstructive sleep apnea or low testosterone or multiple of these conditions just based on someone coming in and saying, you know what, doc, my erections are failing me or I can't rise again. Please do something to help me. And it's not as simple as just prescribing a pill. We need to actually investigate the root cause of that. All right, so I'm going to digress. We're going to talk a little bit more. This is going to be more of a woman's show. We'll talk about overactive bladder, which affects 1 in 3 women in this world. And that is a shocking statistic. That means urinary urgency. That means urinary frequency. That means incontinence, where far too many women in this country, whether you're 22 years old or you're 82 years old, live their life on a pad, live their life on a panty liner, which they need to change several times a day. It may be damp, it may be moist, it may be soaking. Worse yet, too many women are reliant on adult diapers. Stop letting the bladder control your life. There's so many things as urologists that we can do. There's so many advances in terms of modern urology that allow us to get you control of your bladder. First of all, obviously we need to treat the root cause of your overactive bladder. In many cases, it can be you're the cause itself. Why are you drinking 1,000 ounces of water every single day? Obviously, you don't want to be dehydrated. There's certain conditions where you need to consume more water than necessary for the average individual. But 64 ounces is all you need. Eight ounces of water or equivalent a day. If you overdo that, all you're causing yourself is to run to the toilet unnecessarily. And it reaches a point where you think you're doing the right thing. You're doing the right thing by drinking and being well hydrated, but you're taking it to the extreme and it's affecting your social life. It's affecting your professional life. You need to live your life based on where the next bathroom is. That's no way to live. If you're waking up more than twice in the night to urinate, whether you're male or female, something is wrong. If you are basically stop drinking at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, because if you don't, you're going to be waking up 10 times to urinate, something is wrong. If you need to know that you only got 5 minutes to make it to the bathroom or there's going to be a disaster or you're changing your undergarments several times a day, something is wrong. It's almost as if the abnormal gradually becomes your normal. And that's not something that's why it's important to talk about your health problem with your friends, your family, your colleagues, because a lot of times they're going through the same thing and they're the ones who are going to recognize, hey, we've been out to dinner. Why are you going to urinate every 15 minutes? Why are you scared to have a beer with the friends anymore? And dialogue is very important because if, for example, if I provide help, if Dr. Wesley Francis provide help in any way, and then you share that information with someone, that gives somebody hope that there is a solution. That gives them some insight into what is really the root cause of their problem. And if my friend can find a solution, I can find a solution. If my cousin can find a solution, then maybe I can find a solution. And you don't have to live your life in darkness and hopelessness and particularly allowing the bladder to control your life.
So, Greg, there's a question. I'm sure some women would have this. Are there some non-surgical options to manage that situation?
Well, the vast majority are non-surgical. So first of all, obviously, behavioral modifications. Obviously, we do a bladder diary. How many times are you urinating?
Right.
How much fluids are you consuming? Is it more in the daytime? Is it more in the night? What are you consuming? So is it in terms of alcohol? Alcohol will be a diuretic, cause you to pee more frequently. Even young men know if you have six beers, you're going to be peeing all night and waking up and disrupting your sleep. All the time, I'll have patients, the first thing I'll say, do you have any tea at night? Do you have a glass of coffee at night? Yes, doc. Yeah, and I'm peeing six times in the night, and I can't turn off, and I'm waking up at 3, and I don't know why, and I can't fall back to sleep. Caffeine is a stimulant, whether it's in the form of soda, which also has caffeine, if it's in the form of chocolate, a tea, coffee, even the mini, there are studies that have shown even many so-called decaffeinated coffees and tea actually have an element of caffeine. And some individuals, particularly as they get older, are very sensitive to caffeine.
So what are some of the risk factors that lead to women to have, I suppose this is pelvic floor issues that lead to, you know, bladder incontinence. What kind of risk factors go into that?
So incontinence is a broad term. You can look at it in terms of stress incontinence. So every time you cough, you sneeze, you laugh, you lift your grandson, you're going to leak a little bit of urine. There's a saying that says you don't want to be able to laugh, sneeze, cough, and pee all at the same time. And unfortunately, probably 20% of women who've had a child. So even having a child, particularly a vaginal delivery, puts you at risk of having urinary incontinence. That also affects your pelvic musculature. Advancing age also has a role as well. So particularly women who have entered or postmenopausal, they have low estrogen levels, they've had multiple children. Even women who've 25 years old who've had a difficult delivery or prolonged vaginal delivery are at risk of having some form of incontinence. Or you have urge urinary incontinence, which men and women also have, where they just don't make it to the toilet in time. They know they only have 2 minutes to make it. So that's how they live their life. That means if you drive, you have to drive with a cup.
Yeah.
You need to know that you need to be able to drive and pull over to the side of the road and run behind a tree. You can't live your life like that. You going to throughout your day dehydrated because you know if you drink anything, in 10 minutes you're running to pee twice.
So what investigations did you do to really try to identify the root cause of what happens or what contributes to this?
So anything in medicine, you want to obviously determine what is the precipitating factor, how long has the history occurred, what makes it worse, what makes it better, what medications, because medications can notoriously cause issues with polyuria, producing too much in the way of urine in a given day, in terms of overactive bladder, in terms of urgency, where you basically cannot delay. So we're going to look at your caffeine intake. We're going to look at your alcohol intake. Smoking is a stimulant for overactive bladder. So you have to cut out. You shouldn't be smoking cigars or cigarettes. I get a lot of anger backlash when I talk to public about men not smoking cigars, and they don't want to learn or listen or understand that that can cause your bladder cancer, prostate cancer. It can cause lung cancer. It can cause kidney cancer. It can lead to coronary artery disease. So cigars are even, in many cases, more dangerous than filtered cigarettes, and filtered cigarettes are extremely dangerous. So there are many precipitators, but we also need to look at, if you're a female, are you in fact emptying your bladder? So we're going to determine, when you think you've emptied, do you still have a significant quantity of urine left behind?
Right.
Do you have an obstructive cause, whether it's within the pelvis itself that's causing you to pee frequently, whether that's anatomically the rectum lies right beneath bladder, if you have a constipation, even for children. That's the first thing we're going to look at. If you have bedwetting or urinary urgency or frequency in children, are you constipated? That also can tell the nerves that supply the bladder are the same ones that supply the rectum. So if there's inhibition or the nerves are not functioning properly, then that can lead to constipation, and that can lead to issues with your bladder and emptying your bladder and incontinence. But if you have a rectum full of stool, that's reducing the capacity of your bladder because your bladder cannot expand. It's causing an extrinsic compression on the bladder that's causing you to want to pee all the time. Uterine fibroids, the same thing. Commonly, I'd be the one to diagnose someone with uterine fibroids because they want to know whether a 35-year-old is peeing, 47-year-old is peeing every 15 minutes, and it's because they have massive uterine fibroids extrinsically pressing on the bladder, causing them to feel like the bladder is full all the time. So we need to, even if it goes to your dynamics, we want to determine if the nerves are intact. So it's a very exhaustive process, but basically we look for common things first, and then we go down the long list. But there's so many ways that we can minimally invasively get you to have control of your bladder, control of your happiness.
Good stuff.
So our take-home message here is that we want you to live a healthier life. We want you to live a longer life, and that includes mental health, not just physical health. Please get exercise 3 times a week. Please eat healthy. Reduce your processed meat intake, your red meat intake. And if you have a strong history of prostate cancer or breast cancer, please be the first one to get screened. And every individual in the society is at high risk. Let's get screened every single year.
So everybody be safe out there.
Be safe with this impending hurricane. And thank you very much for joining us. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host, Bahamian surgical oncologist, breast cancer expert, and every other kind of cancer expert, Dr. Wesley Francis.